Before we start, okay, welcome everybody. As Dr. Mark mentioned, tonight is an auspicious moment. Really, hi, I mentioned 1918, right? The 18th class and the final class in this series as we come to the end of 2021. That sort of mixes in together. And want to thank everybody for coming and enjoying and listening. We do look forward. Don't know exactly when we're going to pick up. We have actually a couple ideas we're working on, but hopefully soon. Hopefully we won't give Dr. Mark too much of a break, and we'll be back soon on Monday nights at 8:30. And I want to thank Yisrael and Shira Hochberg, who are sponsoring this evening's class in honor of Dr. Mark Shapiro and in appreciation for all his wonderful classes. So thank the Hochbergs, and thank all of you for coming. And okay, doctor, we can get started.
Okay, and I thank the Hochbergs as well. The date is December 27th, 2021. Those who haven't, a number of you are with me live, but you can go to YouTube or the Torah in Motion site, and the class I gave last year on Torah study on Christmas Eve. You can, a number of people emailed me about that. Okay, just a few things before we begin. As always, I want to call your attention. We spoke about Bernard Mandelbaum. Lo and behold, this came out just a couple weeks ago. At Chabad weddings, they often give out, I don't know what you call it, little booklets, which commemorate the wedding and always include letters of the Rebbe. This whole booklet, which I can send it to anyone, a small booklet, is full of letters of the Rebbe to Bernard Mandelbaum, which is, of course, of great interest, their relationship. But even more is, you see, it's incredible, the letters of Bernard Mandelbaum to the Rebbe. Here, Bernard Mandelbaum from the seminary, he's just one of them. He had written something to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe wrote back to him, and Mandelbaum thought that the Rebbe thought that Mandelbaum was criticizing him. So he says, I should put my Rebbe in a position to apologize to me, because the Rebbe apologized to Bernard Mandelbaum. Here you have Bernard Mandelbaum, and he relates to the Lubavitcher Rebbe as his Rebbe. So once again, we see the greatness of the Rebbe to relate to everyone, as the Hebrew expression, Asher Husham, wherever he is. And I found this really interesting. And this, I do not believe that this has anything to do with the classes, but the fact that Nachum Shmariyahu and many, many others emailed me about this shows that they were listening and they saw the videos of Rabbi Mandelbaum. As for women, this is big news from the United Synagogue in England. Women are now permitted to be president of the United Synagogue, not just of the synagogue, but of the whole organization. And the London Beth Din is a conservative with a small C, Beth Din, and very stringent, and they oppose this. You see how slowly these things are changing and in different directions. So I think that's a significant thing. I listened to the class last week, and I saw that I mistakenly said, sometimes, you know, I'm speaking quickly and it's, you catch it because you're listening, but I understand. I sympathize with politicians. Sometimes they misspeak. I said that there are Orthodox synagogues that count women to a minyan, which as I was going off on something, no, that's not true. What I meant to say is count women. Give women aliyahs. But I think most people understood what I meant, but said it out there. At the end of the last class, we got into an issue, or beginning in the middle of the last class, I mentioned it, I think, but then we started discussing it because I threw out there that Ashkenazim don't say Hallel on the night of Pesach and Shul. Well, that comes directly from the Shulchan Aruch. Here you see in the Shulchan Aruch, it's in Tuf Pei Zion, Sif Dalad. The Shulchan Aruch says you do, but the Ramah says V'chol Zeh Ein Anu Nogin Gein Ki Ein Anu Omrim Bolayla B'Pesach Kness says Hallel Kol. The Ramah says we don't say Hallel in the Shul, and you find this in all the Ashkenazic sources. You find it in the Aruch HaShulchan. You find it in the Mishnah Brura. This is the standard halachic approach. But I know that they do say it in certain Ashkenazic shuls. What my question was is, why do they say it? Do they say it because, well, first of all, the Sfardim do say it, or at least most Sfardim. And the Shulchan Aruch says to say it, and Hasidim say it. The Ari was in favor of this, and then it became standard among the Hasidim. So my question was, in the Orthodox, in the typical Ashkenazic shuls that say it, are they saying it because of the Hasidic influence? Or what, is this just a minhag that, despite what the Shulchan Aruch, despite what the Ramah says, and all the other sources, that still existed to say it with a say Hallel, even though the standard Ashkenazic halacha sources said not to? That was the question I threw out there. Now, really, I think the real reason, because many people wrote to me about this shul and that shul says it, I think the real reason you have all these shuls saying it is simply because every shul knows that you have people whose minhag is to say it. They come from Hasidic backgrounds. So what, the attitude is, why not say it? Now, you could say, why not say it? Of course, there's a reason. It could be Bracha Levatola, as we'll see. But I think they want to make everyone feel at home. So, for instance, the hotel I go to for Pesach, you're all cordially invited to join us. If COVID is, I'll be there. We had actually, it was okay last year. Rabbi Kelman once served as the rabbi in residence. What they do is they say it because they figure, well, some people have the minhag, so when you're done, you say it. And that's probably better. I think it was at another hotel I was at. That's my recollection, where they did the davening without saying it, and all the people want to say it. They were stuck afterwards. So we're all going to the seders, and they're remaining in shul to say it. So I think that's actually the reason why many shuls say it, because people have different minhagim and they throw it in. And then we asked the question, what about Rabbi Soloveitchik? Because Rabbi Kelman mentioned that he said to say it, and David Eisen and others. So this is where it gets interesting. So I wanted to know, first of all, many people sent me sources. I had forgotten about this source. Rabbi Binyamin Shlomo Hamburger, Minhag, Shorshe Minhag Ashkenaz. So he has a whole chapter all about giving all the sources. And of course, he's strong into the Ashkenazic Minhag. The problem is the Gra. It's not clear whether the Gra himself held it, or we know his students did it in Eretz Yisrael, but that could be because in Israel, there's no sources that say the Gra did it. And in Israel, they adopted certain practices of the Sfaradim there. We'll get back to the briskers. So that's the real interesting thing. Well, so you can see a whole treatment of it there. Another place you can see a whole treatment, I remember after the class, is this book. It's called Minhag Avoseinu Biyadeinu. And Minhag Avoseinu Biyadeinu is by Rabbi Gedalia Oberlander. Rabbi Gedalia Oberlander is the editor of this Torah journal called Or Yisrael, which he's from Hasidic background, so it has a lot of stuff on Hasidus. And he, over the years, he published many articles, and he brought them together in this volume. And he has a whole chapter on this. Actually, the chapter before saying Hallel in Shul deals with saying Hallel when you bake matzahs Erev Pesach. That is a Hasidic practice, to say Hallel when you, most say it without a bracha. But he also mentions that the Chernobyl Hasidim, the people from that dynasty, they actually say it with a bracha. But that's not the real issue. The real issue is saying Amirat Hallel B'tzibur Pesach Knesset B'leil Pesach. So you get all the sources there, everything you need. So the big question was, what about the briskers? And here is where, hold on, let me get my papers here. Here is where we find something. I don't know how to explain this, for this, because we're not dealing with ancient history here. But listen to this. If you look in Nefesh HaRava of Soloveitchik, which Rabbi Kelman, I think, mentioned or asked about, pages 184 to 185. He says that you do, not only do you say it, I see here I printed it out. I was too lazy to go upstairs and get it. So I printed it out. So I'm going to have to look. I printed out the wrong page, but I'm pulling it up on my computer here. And he says as follows on page, as I said, 183 to 184. Not only does he support saying it, he says that Rabbi Soloveitchik, he says, would recommend, would counsel the rabbis, the students, that if they can do it without making a dispute, it's kedai, it's appropriate, it's proper for them to institute challah with a bracha in shul on both nights of Pesach, and because he thought that that was the Me'ikar Adin. And then Rav Shachter adds in that in Yateg Naaman, it pointed out that the minhag of Rav Chaim was not to say challah on the night of Pesach. Well, that's where I'm surprised Rav Shachter didn't refer to the major source of the Rav. The major source is in Shirim, was Echer Abba Mari, Volume 1, page 15, where the Rav says as follows, that my grandfather, Rav Chaim, he established halacha like the Shulchan Aruch, not like the Ramah, that it's a mitzvah to say halo. And the Rav gives in Shul, and the Rav gives the entire lundus, the difference between halo and Shul versus at the Seder. And he says he would be mitzvah al kol b'nei beso. He would have all of his sons tell them to say halal. And the Rav quotes his father. He says, my father told me that some person was questioned this ruling of Reb Chaim. After all, it goes against the Ashkenazic practice. And Reb Chaim got angry. Kas, he got angry at him. And he cited a pasuk in Yeshayahu that he thought proved it, the point. So here you have the Rav quoting his father that Reb Chaim held very strongly of this. On the other hand, if you look in the Hamburger book, this is, I don't know what to make, how to deal with this. Because if you look at the Hamburger book, page 278 and 279, you get the entire different story. It tells us that the Brisker Rav, and we have students, of not just students, it's quoting the Brisker Rav's two sons, that's Rav Velvel, as saying, and it's Yadua, the Brisker Rav would never, not only wouldn't the Brisker Rav say halal in the shul, when he davened with the shul in Jerusalem, even in Jerusalem, where they would say it, because that's the minhag, he would leave the room and go somewhere else. And then it explains that there is this rumor, which comes from the Rav. That's the rumor they claim, that Reb Chaim said it. And that's where you get the passage in Yateg Naaman, not only denying it in the name of the Brisker Rav's two sons. Yadua ki minhag beis brisk shalom lomar halal b'leil ha-Pesach. And then it gives a whole story where the Rav Velvel, the other son of Reb Chaim, was in Brisk, and there was one shul in Brisk. He quotes here, Rav Steinman pointed out that there was one shul in Brisk that did say halal, and Rabbi Rav Velvel went to Reb Chaim and said he heard him saying halal, and it was so nice. It was geschmack for Yom Tov. So what did Reb Chaim say to him? Because Reb Chaim thought that he was impressed with this. And he quotes Reb Chaim as saying as follows, If we believe that a certain practice should not be done on according to halacha, is a geshmak. There's no geshmak. You can't say that something has a good taste, a good geshmak, because if against halacha, by definition, it can't have a good geshmak. So, and since we hold she'ein lomar halo, ein baza, there's no geshmak there. And there's no hislavus ruchani. You can't be spiritually inspired by something which is against the halacha. So here you have the Rav quoting his father, and then you saying one thing in the name of Chaim, and then you have the sons of the Brisker Rav, Rav Soloveitch's cousins, quoting their father, the Brisker Rav, saying the exact opposite. I don't know how to explain this. It's beyond strange. What can I tell you? There is one other point I'll mention, though, there's a contradiction between Hamburger and Oberlander, because Hamburger cites one source that says the Chassam Sofer, as it's known, never said it. He would never say halal in Yom Ha'atzmaut, Pesach night. But if you look in Oberlander, he quotes another source, the Maram Shik, as I recall, that no, they would say it. Yes, they'd say it without a bracha. So that's the Chassam. So I don't know. And Oberlander also mentions on page 390 that even in regular Ashkenazic shuls, that is not Hasidic shuls, in the 19th century, this practice was already seeping in. So that was my question. Is this just something new, or was it? No, already in the 19th century, for example, in the days of Rabbi Yehuda Assad in Hungary, and other, he quotes a few different Hungarian sources that show that there were Ashkenazic non-Hasidic shuls that started adopting the practice. So that sort of answers the question that it's not just something that we do because of the Hasidim. How to explain this issue with the Briskers? I have no clue. It's a direct contradiction. The last thing I'll do, we don't have that much to do in terms of the major sources, so let me just take the time to do this now. Five more minutes. Remember this book? Proceedings of the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards. Just want to share with you one more thing of this before we continue and finish up. Because as we're going to be wrapping it, bringing it to a close, I want to say it's worthwhile bringing this in as well. This is volume three, and it collects more material about all different aspects of Jewish law and in the conservative movement. If you look on page 1081, you have here from the proceedings about Isaac Klein. Remember we said Isaac Klein, conservative rabbi, a real conservative rabbi, but coming from an Orthodox background, the rabbi of the synagogue in Springfield, his successor is Norman Lamb. He tells the story on page 101 that when he was in Springfield, there was pressure for mixed pews. And even though he believed in mixed pews, he prevented it because he said that this is an Orthodox synagogue. And as long as it's an Orthodox synagogue, we should not have mixed pews. And that if you want to change, you want mixed pews, change the constitution to say conservative synagogue. So that's pretty impressive by Rabbi Isaac Klein. Most conservative rabbis would have jumped at the chance to put in mixed pews. On page 1171, you have here, getting back to the Shabbos tshuva that we spoke about. I had a long conversation today with a conservative rabbi who said, you have to understand the reality of the times. He came from the Midwest. You could have a shul of 500 people. Everyone drove on Shabbos. So the idea that you would tell them, you know, not to drive, I agree, it's incomprehensible, but that's different than actually having a response and permitting it. Rabbi Samuel Rosenblatt, he's the rabbi of Beth Tefillah. I got a long, detailed description from Rabbi Wolberg of the history of Beth Tefillah. Beth Tefillah, there was a break. A group wanted mixed seating, and the shul split in the I think it was the 19, right after World War II. And Beth Tefillah remained with the Mechitza. And then there was a group in Beth Tefillah. The compromise was there was pressure for mixed seating. So the compromise was Beth Tefillah had separate seating and no Mechitza. Rabbi David Novak becomes rabbi of Beth Tefillah, conservative rabbi, after Rabbi Rosenblatt. And Rabbi Wolberg comes to Beth Tefillah in 1978. It only joins the OU in the Orthodox Union. Rabbi Wolberg says we were the last synagogue to join the OU without a mechitza. Rabbi Wolberg was able to get them to put a mechitza in 2003. But Rabbi Rosenblatt was the rabbi of an Orthodox synagogue, and he's also in the rabbinical assembly. But look what he says. He says about the Shabbos tshuva. He writes already, he talks about how the majority report, namely permitting driving on Shabbos to the shul. So who, if everyone's driving anyway, who does this help? I think it helps the rabbi and the cantor, because they too could live far from the shul and drive there. Otherwise, who's it helping? He says as follows, I say that this publication, the consequences of it is the only thing they will remember is the heter, to drive on Shabbos. They will forget about the calls for the observance of the Sabbath and whatnot. Already in the eyes of the layman, conservative Judaism stands for the right to be Mechal Shabbos and to eat treifos. He goes on and talking about how disgraceful this is. So I find it interesting that he's a member, though, of the rabbinical assembly. It continues, Rabbi Isaac Klein also says, page 1,174, I am firmly convinced that a tshuva about riding on Shabbat will have the single effect of spreading irreligion. Those people who ride on Shabbat will not stop riding to the movies. They will also ride to shul. They will not stop. In other words, Rabbi Isaac Cohen is saying that this is going to lead to a terrible situation as well. On page 1186, you have Rabbi Theodore Friedman, one of the authors of the tshuva. Remember, it was Rabbi Agus, Jacob Agus. It was Rabbi Morris Friedman and Rabbi Theodore Friedman. He says in 1961 how upsetting it is that you have people riding to shul, not just to their shul, they're going to a bar mitzvah or they're doing other things. And he says the responsum deliberately limits the permissibility of riding on Sabbath to a specific concrete situation that you live too far from the shul. However, he says that you cannot extend this to drive to a shul, let's say, for a bar purpose, attending a bar mitzvah or for Bikur Cholim. And it got to be so bad that the rabbinical assembly itself, and this is Palatine on page 1188, had to come out with a statement saying that that the responsum we had for Heter to drive to shul on Shabbos does not include travel for social purposes, nor does it include travel to the synagogue in order to attend the bat mitzvah ceremony or reception, etc., etc. So I think it's significant that we see a recognition, even in the movement, that this was a mistake. There's two more things. On page, I think it's here, it is 1481. Yes. So on 1481, the famous question of Ben-Gurion to the Jewish leaders, who is a Jew? So he approached also the people from the Jewish Theological Seminary. And you have letters here, for example, from Heschel and from Kaplan. And believe it or not, Kaplan says, in the case where the parents of a child of a non-Jewish mother wish to recognize, register him as a Jew, the Israeli government has the right to recognize him as a Jew. That's Mordechai Kaplan in the... In 1959, the very next page is Lieberman's letter, truly a tshuva, you could say, perhaps. And of course, there's no doubt what Lieberman's going to say. It's perfectly clear and without a shadow of a doubt that a son born to a Jew by a non-Jewish wife is not called his son and is considered a non-Jew in all respects. I have some other things. If we have time at the end, I'm holding on to them. If we have a few more minutes, even if it's 9:30, I'll take a few more minutes because I have a few more things to show, but it's not directly relevant. It relates to things in previous weeks. So I want to pick up and conclude with the last issue we're going to talk about, namely the women's issue, such an important issue. I was reading Halivni's autobiography. I realized afterwards when I was listening to it, I forgot to mention on pages 107 to 108, Halivni discusses in more detail his conflict over this issue with Gerson Cohen. He says, when Lieberman dies in 1983, Gerson Cohen did not ask me to deliver the eulogy, even though I was then chairman of the Talmud and Rabbinics Department. And he also notified, Halivni describes how he notified him that he was going to circulate a letter starting with the next Sabbath, that is Halivni, would no longer be the rabbi of the seminary synagogue, even though Halivni held this position whenever Lieberman was away. So when I subsequently asked him, what are you signaling, Gerson? He told me, I want to break the Lieberman syndrome. And Halivni explains that in addition to dethroning Talmud, which was associated with Lieberman, he wanted to get the movement, the seminary, more involved in the community life of the average conservative congregation, which, of course, was already ready for the feminist innovations. Also, this is important as well. In discussing the Wenger article, remember I gave the vote. I told you the vote was 38-4 by the seminary faculty to permit female ordination. And I mentioned that Halivni refused to take part in the vote. What I didn't mention, I don't know how I didn't mention it, was it wasn't just Halivni. It was, you can see the description on page 513, that the opponents of ordination which represented a significant portion of the Talmud faculty, refused to participate in the vote. That is, the people we saw, Frankis, Faur, Dimitrovsky, Halivni Weiss, they refused to participate in the vote because they thought it was invalid, that a halachic matter can't be decided by faculty members who are not learned in halacha. There were still eight people voted against it, but the Talmud faculty, I read to you even last class what Halivni says, why he's boycotting the vote. I don't mean to imply, and I think maybe some took it this way, that there were no members of the Talmud faculty that did not support ordination. There were. Rabbi Joel Roth, who was a younger faculty member, he wrote the important responsum supporting ordination. And Professor Judith Hauptman, who was a new member of the faculty, she also supported it. But the senior members of the faculty, the other one I didn't mention, Zlotnick, they opposed it, and they refused to vote. Now, in the Wenger article, she says as follows on page 522. After Lieberman's death, some faculty members claimed that he had composed an unpublished responsum that prohibited women's ordination. However, many faculty members have questioned the validity of those claims. And then her source for this is Gordon Tucker interview, Judith Hauptman interview. Now, this is an incredible statement simply because we have the responsum, and it was published in the book published by the Union of Traditional Judaism. They actually published the I included in Sholem and Orthodox the typed version with notes. But if you look in the Tomech HaLacha volume, they include a copy of the actual Ktav Yad, the manuscript of Lieberman. So I don't know how anyone how Gordon Tucker and Judith Hauptman didn't know about it. What I wrote in Sol Lieberman the Orthodox is as follows. Pay attention to this. After what I just quoted from Wenger, I said, one wonders how it was possible that neither Wenger nor her two sources were aware that Lieberman's responsum was posthumously published in Wayne R. Allen, Tomecha Ocha. I don't know how. And that's what I wrote. Anyone reading this would see that this isn't a question that, did he write it or not? He wrote it. We have it. We have the actual in his manuscript, in his handwriting. Well, this gets into what I mentioned about Dov Zlotnick. I'll tell you the story now. I have been worthy once in my life, only once in my life, to make a shidduch. And I made a shidduch, and I was at the wedding. I think this was 2004. Let's see, this book came out in 2006. It was just a couple months afterwards. And my name was mentioned because I'm the one who made the shidduch. So my name was mentioned. And that's probably how Dov Zlotnick knew I was there. Because while I'm sitting, because they thanked Mark Shapiro for making this day possible. Someone comes over to me at the table and says that Professor Zlotnick would like to speak to you because he was at the wedding. I had never met him. And he must have just said to someone, find Shapiro, I want to speak to him. So I go over there, and he's standing, and I'm standing, and there's a few people surrounding us. And he first says that he enjoyed very much my booklet, Sholem and Orthodox, but... And then he goes into a harangue against me that... how could I have had that note saying that, in quoting who I did, Gordon Tucker and Judith Hauptman, that some people claim that Lieberman never wrote this. How could I, you know, thinking this is terrible what I did. And I said, I don't understand. I quoted them. They said it. It's in the standard article on female ordination. But I also said that this is impossible. I don't understand how they could say this. We actually have the manuscript. I published the manuscript. And he does not accept what I'm saying. And now there's a bigger crowd because he's getting angry. He's saying the very fact that you cited them is itself a disgrace. They do not deserve to be cited. This is your, it's almost, he didn't say it, but it's almost like the old argument, don't, mention Nazi, mention Holocaust revisionists because you're giving them validity. He's going after me saying it was a disgrace. You never should have even given them the dignity of mentioning him because when you mention someone to then refute them, you're giving them a certain status. And he said his piece, and then he calmed down, then we continued the conversation, and it ended in a good note. And for a while after that, I was wondering, you know, was he right? Is there anything? And now I can say 15 years later, I still don't understand that. For a while, I was wondering, maybe he's right. But no, I don't think so. I didn't do anything wrong. They said it. It's in a book. Most people will read it. They'll see this. They'll think there's some validity, perhaps. And I point out that the thing is published. But you see, I understand Dov Zotnik. He was a Talmud Mufak. He was the executor of the will. They were so close to the family, the closest of everyone, probably, with the Zotniks and to Lieberman. And the very idea that I would mention something so ridiculous, even if to refute it, to him, he just, it was beyond the pale for him. And I thought that was, so that's this time when Dov Zlotnik gave me Musser, but I don't accept the Musser because sometimes you need to cite something, even if it's clearly incorrect, and then you point it out it's incorrect. If anyone could ask, it could be that Beth Wenger misunderstood what Gordon Tucker or Judith Outman said. I find it very hard to believe that they were not aware of this responsum of Lieberman, which not only was published, but it was circulated as well. It's not like it's unknown. I've never asked either of them. I don't know either of them, although I've spoken to one of them, but someone here must know Ethan Tucker. You can ask him also, perhaps. I have to assume it's a misunderstanding, and maybe they said that that people misunderstood the intent of Lieberman's responsum, maybe along the lines that Novak said. I don't know, but to deny the existence of it, that's the language. After Lieberman's death, some faculty members claimed that he had composed an unpublished responsum. Many faculty members have questioned the validity of those claims. I don't know what there's the question. We've seen the responsum. We studied it a bit last week. Zachary writes to me, I raised the question why Lieberman focuses on halacha, not on masorah, not on tradition. And he says, perhaps correctly, that had Lieberman offered, you know, the policy arguments, the tradition, then the conservative movement is not bound to tradition. So if the argument you're going to give us is about tradition, well, tradition can change much easier than halacha can change. So that's perhaps why he had to reach for halacha. The final thing I want to mention about women's ordination is to show you how much things have changed even in the Orthodox world. The journal Chakira, I like the journal very much. A number of years ago, it had an issue where it had two discussions. Of the fact that you can even have a discussion about women in the rabbinate, an actual academic-like discussion, shows that there's a big change than what it was, let's say, 20 years ago. So one of the articles is this one by Rabbi Michael Broyd and Rabbi Shlomo Brody. Shlomo Brody in Israel and Broyd in America. And it's a long article. And they don't discount the possibility of women rabbis. They even cite Norman Lamb, that hold on a second. Here, this is what Norman Lamb said. He gave an interview to the YU commentator in 2010. He says that things have to be done gradually, think times change. When asked by what I think about women rabbis, his reply, Lamb, is, it's going too fast. I did not say it was wrong. I did not say it was right. It just has not paced itself properly. I was criticized, of course. People asked, you mean that al pi din, they're allowed to become rabbis? My response, I don't know. Are you sure they're not allowed to? So here you see Norman Lamb not saying it's absolutely incorrect. He's saying that he's not sure and that maybe it could be in the future. That's very different than what we've seen before in the discussions of women rabbis. That's in the Orthodox world. It's different than the OU statement. If you read Brody and Broyd, their argument is that they think it's a possibility. They think it has to be done slowly. We're not ready for it yet. It's they conclude by saying that Women should sit and study for increasing long periods of time, write serious scholarship in Torah, develop as inspiring serious personas, and lead Torah institutions in function, if not form. And in short, they should build the Orthodox community brick by brick and see what happens over time. The passage of time, as Rabbi Lam observes, solves many problems. We endorse this approach. So they do not oppose with women rabbis. They say at the, it shouldn't be done by fiat. At the present, this should be something that over time, slowly, that if it happens, it'll be seen as natural because it'll be like expected, and no one will take it at all. And you'll have women who are great poskot and writing things. So if you call them a rabbi, I'm not referring to a shul rabbi necessarily, that it'll be something that no one sees at all surprising. So this is an article acknowledging the possibility of women rabbis appearing in Hakira, which is not a liberal Orthodox journal, but saying that at present, we still need some more time because in the Orthodox world, they use some analogy in there, something like it's about orthodontics or something, that things move very slowly. But that's an acknowledgement. Now, but are they talking about a shul as well, or just they're not clear. You heard my point last week. The big issue is about shuls, because if it's not about shuls, what's the difference? Well, why couldn't you have a woman doing everything a man's doing in terms of teaching? And the OU statement only refers to shuls. So I'm presuming they're referring to shuls as well. Unless you say it's just smicha for things other than shuls, but then really, what's the issue? You can give them any ordination you want. Just call it something else. I don't know. In the same issue, though, you have another article with a different position by Rav Hershel Schachter. And it's a short article, and he has 2 points. The first is he deals with Sarara, the idea that a woman's not supposed to have these positions of authority, which is a very difficult argument to make, although the Rav held this apparently about Shochtim and others. The reason, and Shul presidents, the reason why it's difficult is because if you look at how the characteristics of Sarara, it doesn't really apply, at least in what we normally think of to be, even for a rabbi, people were hired, it could be fired, not to mention the fact that converts, I think it's almost universally assumed that in our day and age, a convert who's not supposed to have a position of authority can be a shul rabbi because that's not the classic idea of a sarara, of the rulership that they refer to. In fact, I saw they mention this. Where is it? I saw that. Let me find it. They write to Broyd and Brody. In the course of writing this essay, we spoke with a senior administrator at a universally respected yeshiva that regularly issues Yori Yari Yad Yad and Smicha. He told us that his yeshiva planned to issue this distinguished smicha to a student who was a ger as a sign of his accomplishment in his learning, even as he would be instructed that he could not serve as a dayan, but he would be able to serve as a shul rabbi. And I think this is standard, as far as I know. There are converts who are rabbis. They couldn't be dayanim, but they are shul rabbis. The typical one, I think, is a case where the father is Jewish, the mother's not Jewish. But correct me if I'm wrong. I guess Rav Schachter thinks, well, he does think, you can see it from here, that a convert could be a teacher, but he can't be a shul rabbi. That's Rav Schachter's position. As far as I know, it's not the RICA's position. And I don't know if this is the generally accepted position. But that's the first thing he argues. And the second thing he argues is the Lieberman point, that the rabbi needs to follow from the dayan. He talks. He does the same argument that Lieberman does, but he attributes it. Take a look here, page 4. Years ago, when the Jewish Theological Seminary was considering ordaining women, Rabbi Shaul Lieberman expressed his extreme disapproval. He quoted Rishonim that the modern imitation smicha is in a certain sense a carryover from the smicha vote, et cetera, et cetera. Look, note 25. See, Mark B. Shapiro, Saul Lieberman, the Orthodox. So I find it of note that for Hershel Schachter, the two major arguments, the second argument is based on the Lieberman approach. I don't know if Rabbi Schachter would have come to this argument without Lieberman. he's the first one to make this claim that you can't ordain women because giving them the title rabbi, this by using smicha, is creating a problem because rabbi is connected to the original smicha, which is connected to Dayonos. So the solution for this would be if you didn't call them rabbi, and it's clear that it's a different sort of ordination. And he concludes, therefore, according to the Rishonim quoted by Rabbi Lieberman, today's imitation of smicha, being a carryover from the biblical smicha of old, ought not to be granted to women. So as I said, I think it's noteworthy that of the two major arguments Rav Schechter uses, and this argument is also mentioned in the OU statement, that it comes from Lieberman. So Lieberman, although his argument does not have any influence in the conservative movement, that is the mainstream conservative movement, it did influence the Union of Traditional Judaism, which dropped the type name conservative. Here you see Lieberman's argument actually having an influence in the Orthodox world with really the most important and influential posek in America, Rav Hershel Schechter. So, and maybe that's fitting, because as we've seen for all his teaching at the seminary and his work there, and the importance that he saw as the institution, especially in the early years, and the valuable works he accomplished there, he never was part of that world in a religious sense. He always was part of the traditional Torah world. At least he saw that himself as part of it. If you recall, he said that the rabbis who opposed me, that I know certain facts that they don't know. And the mainly being that he's able to keep the movement, the conservative movement, on the straight and narrow. He's teaching halacha to people who may otherwise wouldn't get the proper halacha. So with that, we really come to the end of what's been 18 weeks. 18 weeks, as Rabbi Kelman said, if you said that we can have 18 weeks on one figure, Rav Shaul Lieberman, people think you're crazy. One class, two classes, people get bored after three or four. I think I'm fair to say that we kept it 18 weeks. It was not boring. It was always interesting. And I have to thank all of you listening, those who listen live. We get at 75, 80 a week, as well as all those who are listening afterwards, and most in the Orthodox world, but many, many in the conservative world, all the questions and comments. And believe me, we could have gone another 18 if I would have elaborated on many things, but 18 is enough. I thank you again. Chazal, tell us that you weren't, assuming that you're my students of a sort for these classes, that you learn most from your students. And I have learned, as always, as every one of the classes, a great deal from all the comments, all the questions, everything that's been pointed out, especially in this one, because we had, here's the very first class we did it was posted August 10th. Class number one, you see almost 1,800 views. That's a lot of views. That's about 100 new viewers a week. So people are interested in the topic, and I thank Rabbi Kelman. It was he who asked me to do it, and it was a lot of work preparing it and finding the materials in addition to what was in Shaul Lieberman. But I really loved it because it took us, if you remember, we began in Lita, the Torah word in Lithuania, the Lithuania yeshivas. And then we moved on to Eretz Yisrael with Rav Kook and what's going on in Eretz Yisrael and the Hebrew University and the movement from a traditional Talmudist to an academic Talmudist and the Chazon Ish. And then the move to America. And what is the Jewish Theological Seminary and the Orthodox and the Reform battles? And you know, where do you draw the line? And then the development of conservative Judaism as a movement with its own halachic approach, and how the rabbis then related to Lieberman and his role. So we really covered so many different areas, and I'm very happy to have done it. I will take the questions now. Well, maybe we'll actually finish 9:30 for the first time. Before that, though, I do want to show you one more thing, because I forget who it was, who sent it to me. But if you recall, a few classes ago when I showed you the cheerleaders, actually, I'll show you two things. I said that I couldn't find Rama's yearbook. So here you go. There you go. This is 1964, the Rama's cheerleaders. So don't say I didn't show you the Rama's cheerleaders. And I did want to show one other thing because, Grant, this is not me speaking. We spoke a lot about mitzvah taunts. If you remember not this semester, the previous semester, I wanted something just, there was a big bubble of wedding. So, some of you will get a kick out of this. It's not for me to, I don't criticize Hasidus. That's not my thing. But, this guy, has it in for Hasidim. I think some of you will find this interesting. He says as follows, if this was a modern wedding and the chassan was dancing with the kala, and I'll show you in a second, with hundreds of men standing around clapping and ogling her, and the modern rabbi running circles around them, everyone would be screaming pritzis, not sneistic. But if they're Hasidim doing it with the Rebbe, running around with his fancy bathrobe, then of course it's okay, because this is a holy minhag. Okay, so we see who doesn't like Hasidim, but here it is. So as we said, don't let anyone tell you that at Hasidic weddings there's no mixed dancing. The attendees don't get to mix dance, but the chassan and kala, they do their dance in front of everyone. I will take now the questions and comments. And again, it's I always feel like we come to the end. We should do a siyum of sorts, but I couldn't have done it without you all. Thank you very much. Mark says that Ashkenazi and Nusach Sfarad say Hallel Pesach Adar. Yes, because Nusach Sfarad, when I say Ashkenazim, I shouldn't maybe use it because today it's understood. But for example, if you went to, they used to say Ashkenazim where it was Hasidim and Ashkenazim. That's for Hungary, for instance, they would call them Ashkenazim because they daven Nusach Ashkenaz. So you had Ashkenazim and then you had the ones who, Nusach Sfarad is a Hasidic innovation. The Ari, Rav Yitzchak Luria, Nusach Sfarad is Nusach Ari, basically. It's an adaptation of the Kabbalistic ideas of the Ari and other Sephardic things. So yes, we call these shuls, they're Ashkenazim, Udava Nusach Sfarad, but that's not Nusach Ashkenaz. So yes, they are Ashkenazim in that they come from Poland and places like that, but that's not Nusach Ashkenaz. That's not what we mean when we say Ashkenazic Minhag. Ashkenazic Minhag is the Minhag of the Maril and the Ramah and everything up to modern days. Hadassah says, if you daven at a place that does say Hallel and it's not your minhag to say it, are you allowed to leave prior to them saying it? Yes, you can leave. Sure, you can leave. Not only can you leave, some people say the Brisker Rav left, it's a problem because it could be Bracha Levatola. But I think most assume it's not. Look, it's hard to say it's a Bracha Levatola. When Rav Soloveitchik says to say it, I don't see how you could say it's a Bracha Levatola. But if you're a stickler, like the Brisker Rav would leave, you can leave if you want to leave. Someone emailed me or texted me that in Rabbi Adler's shul in Tinek, and he's a big student of the Rav, it's very inspiring. And I think a shul like that also, many people who wouldn't have had the minhag, now that their shul does it, they do it, they say it. The reason to leave, I guess, would be because maybe the young shaders these days are so late because we don't never set the clocks. The clock is always, it's the later times. So you start earlier. Most people will stay, but no, you can leave. Someone privately texts me that Rav Hamburger has an updated, much expanded version of this chapter. A separate booklet. Yes, and he clarifies the matter. Rav Hamburger is very strong that this is not something that non-Hasidic Ashkenazim should be doing. We have this problem because we're Soloveitchik. He has a tradition from his father. I don't know if one side is wrong or they're both right. And Reb Chaim had different opinions at different times. And also, with all due respect to Reb Hamburger, he doesn't mention some of the sources that Oberlander mentions, that in Hungary, among real Ashkenazic, that is not Hasidic influenced communities, this practice started seeping in. And Rabbi Steinman testified that, he does quote this, that there was one shul in Brisk that, well, maybe that show was influenced by the Hasidim because there were Hasidim in Lithuania also. So you do have some non-Hasidim who said it. Baruch says Oberlanders of Lubavitcher. Yes, the Oberlanders, they come from Papa, but they changed and moved into Chabad. correct. William Gewert says, Rav Chaim and Rav Elvel used to argue about whether or not to say Hallel and Shul on the first night of Pesach. That argument took place already in Brisk. Okay, and it's quoted at length in the two-volume Brisker Haggadah. The thing is that in Hamburger's book, he shows that once that appeared, there was a public statement in Yateid Ne'eman denying the truth of the story and saying it's not true, that the real story is that Rav Elvel was impressed and Rav Chaim said not to be impressed because you can't have geschmack if it's against the halacha as we understand it in our tradition. So then you can find all that in the Hamburger volume. But again, how do you deny what Rav Soloveitchik quotes? His father told him this.
It's explicit in the Haggadah.
Yes, but I know it's explicit. But if you look in the Hamburger book, he quotes the Haggadah of Pesach, and he says, it's on page 278. It's in the Haggadah, the Beis Halevi. According to this, that Reb Chaim used to say Hallel in the shul, but his son disagreed with him and didn't say it in the shul, only Haggadah. And then it quotes what the Rav quotes, the same thing the Rav quotes, that someone, you know, would question this practice, and Reb Chaim rebukes him and quotes the pasuk in Yeshaya, Hashir Yelachem, Kaleis Kadesh Chag. And according to the base of the Lady Haggadah, it was Rav Elvel who challenged his father. And that's what it says there. However, if you read Hamburger, it says a short while after the publication of this Haggadah, the whole story was contradicted. And the Haggadah author itself, Rabbi Gerlitz, publicized in Yateid Ne'eman, Hareini Lahodia Kilachar HaBeror Huvharli, after I determined that after investigating it, which this whole story, and that they come from a non-reliable source. A non-reliable source is Rabbi Soloveitchik. See, this Gerlitz fellow, he's a plagiarizer. He plagiarizes, he already came out, he's come out with all sorts of brisker stuff. He plagiarizes from Rav Schechter's stuff, he plagiarizes from the Rav. He took it from Rav Soloveitchik. And he must have heard that the unnamed person is Rav Elvel. So now he's saying it's not reliable. And so I've heard from, and he quotes the sons of Rav Elvel. But fine, so the sons of Rav Elvel deny it. And then we know people were alive. Rav Elvel did not say it. But the question is, what did Rav Chaim do? The Rav says Rav Chaim said it. And they quote here that... he didn't say it. I think the answer is as follows. Now that I think of it, because who says this story is correct, this story about the geschmack? I think the answer is as follows. The Reb Chaim said it. This is what makes the most sense. And Rav Elvel disagreed. And that makes sense. That fits in. You have the sons of Rav Elvel saying that our father never said it. They're not quoted as saying anything here about the grandfather. And... well, actually, they do. They do say that the story of Rav Chaim is not true. But they weren't there. We know Rav Elvel didn't say it. The Rav, and the story, as it's told, agrees that Rav Elvel didn't say it, but Rav Chaim did say it. And the Rav quotes his father specifically telling him that his father said it. So I think you have to say that Rav Chaim said it. And Rabbi Shunno says that Rabbi Robert Gordis said that the tshuva on driving on Shabbat was a huge mistake. I think the conservative rabbi I spoke to today would say it's not a mistake because at the end of the day, the people were all driving anyway. And who does it affect other than the rabbis? It gives them the hector to drive. But what it did is, and I really hope that the people who are in the conservative movement who've been listening, and there have been many, do not think I haven't been unfair. Obviously, I have a different perspective, but I've tried to be fair and try to put both sides. I think what you can say is that even for the conservative movement, it doesn't leave you anything to strive for. If it's like Chabad, if you know that people are driving the shul, but you don't give an imprimatur, what this means is that the people who are striving to be better, to do more mitzvos, when they move to a new community, if they have a choice of moving closer, maybe these people, let's say you went to Ramah, and they understand what Shabbos is about, they will move. It won't be the best house, perhaps, or the house they most want, but it'll be within a mile of the shul, so they'll move there. But now when there's a hetter telling them they can move anywhere they want, it's those sort of people who would be hurt, I think, by it. Moshe says that even Wolfson's response to the Ben-Gurion question was in line with the Orthodox understanding of matrimony. I have to say that. I don't even remember Wolfson's response. I'll have to take a look at the book. Thank you. And Mel says the number of conservative Jews who drove to shul on Shabbos but did not drive anywhere else is vanishingly small, if not zero. That is true. And that's what, in fact, in the passage of, which I didn't read you, Samuel Rosenblatt goes on and says that those people, he says 99.99% of the people, they drive to shul and they drive everywhere else as well. But they were doing it, as the conservative rabbi said, they were doing it anyway. But my point would be that it doesn't, you want to have something for people to strive for. So granted, to drive in the shul, but it should be something to encourage them not to. And it's very difficult to encourage people not to drive to shul at all if you're driving to shul on Shabbos, because you're driving to shul on Shabbos, so you have to get gas. So then you got to stop. Oh, I have to get something at the store. And then there's no sense of Shabbos. So Rabbi David Wolpe. Okay, so now I have to say that we're graced with the honor of, I think, perhaps the most important conservative rabbi in America. So I it's a great honor for me to have Rabbi Wolpe with us. Obviously, not just, when I say the most important, I don't just mean size of shul, but I mean in terms of influence. And as a public intellectual, maybe I would say from the if Meir Soloveitchik is the public intellectual on the from the conservative, Rabbi Wolpe maybe on the other side, although I highly encourage everyone to look at some of the right work on academic freedom and other things. So I'm honored, and all of us are honored, Rabbi Wolpe, to have you with us here, and I hope you too think that I did justice to a movement of which you are currently a leader of, and I was describing a movement, and my sympathies, as everyone could tell, are more with a previous iteration of the movement, I guess in the era of your father, and maybe in your youth growing up in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And Rabbi Wolpe points out it includes a very small number, but does include some rabbis. Yes, rabbis and cantors often would not drive on Shabbos. And I've known conservative Jews, real conservative Jews, who did not drive on Shabbos. I met them in college, Ramah. People went to Ramah. The problem was that often then they would have to come to Orthodox synagogues. Why? Because, and we had a lot of this at KUE in Manhattan, because if you're a real conservative Jew and you take the movement seriously, that is, you have to keep kosher, you have to observe Shabbos, problem is you're going to go to a typical conservative synagogue and your children have no one to play with because no one keeps Shabbos. And on Saturday, there's no one, and no one's keeping kosher, so they are forced to compromise by going to the Orthodox shul with the mechitza. But as I said to one of these people once who mentioned that to me, I said, we all compromise. You don't think I compromise when I go to the Orthodox synagogue? And some of the nonsense we hear at the Orthodox synagogue, every single one of us compromises. That we all have things that we hate about the movements we're in. But that's, you got to take the good with the bad. And hopefully the good's a lot more than the bad. iPad says, tradition in the past has a vote, but not a veto, applies to conservative Judaism. Yes, but also to other streams as well. Mordechai Kaplan said that as well, that tradition has a vote, not a veto. Thank you, Yellen. Why Yellen? Rabbi Yellen, the Chakir articles are published in 2011. What I find most significant is that they're coming from the right, Chakira, that they would even see this as something worthy of debate. And I've spoken about this journal, Chakira, how it's really been taken over by the modern Orthodox, even though it comes out of the more Haredi world. Privately, someone says, how to rationalize a woman rabbi not being counted for a minyan in her shul. Well, I said already last class that in the Orthodox world, the people arguing for women rabbis has nothing to do with minyan. But why does a woman have to be counted for a minyan? Minyan's a special thing. It's a special halacha in minyan. But what does that have to do with leaving the synagogue? Just like the rabbi can't be counted for, most rabbis are not given the first aliyah. They can't do pidyon habein, things like that. And many rabbis, if they're kohanim, they can't do funerals the way typical funerals. So just because a woman is the rabbi, who says she should be counted in a minyan? We saw that the conservative movement went along that path. That is, those arguing, Joel Roth and others, that by definition, the rabbi has to be counted in a minyan. But in the Orthodox world, there never was any thought of that. Someone privately emailed me during the week that his daughters went to the seminary and became a rabbi. And Halivni told her, however, don't get an aliyah. I think that's what he told me. Don't get an aliyah with men, which that's the old traditional position. Even in the Orthodox now, many of them got. But he also told her, don't be a witness at a wedding. Because again, being a witness, I understand from the modern conservative perspective that by if you're the rabbi, how could you not be a witness? But a witness, that's like a technical thing. And at a wedding, I'm talking about for a kiyum of the kiddushin. So the two things are separate. Ruth says halachic change operates in geologic time, like the movements of the continents. Oh, is that that? I don't remember if that's what the Brody article says. They also do something in there about the orthodontists. iPad. If women Orthodox are given title rabbi, even if not for a shul rabbi use, can they then ordain men with the title rabbi for use in a shul or as a dayan? Why not? Rabbi only means you're learned. It doesn't mean anything else. It doesn't have to give you any special authority. This isn't like the Catholic Church when you become a priest. And now that you can hear confession and use, do the Eucharist and turn the wafer and the wine into the body and blood. We don't have that. The rabbi is just a learned person. So why couldn't a woman declare on a document that so-and-so is learned and he's worthy of serving as a teacher in Israel? That's not a halachic matter at all. I think it's important to distinguish what's halachic and what's not. Okay, thank you. Rabbi Wolpe, again, I know you're very busy, and but the fact that we're all honored that you found the time, different time zone as well. Any final comments? Bill Gewertz, he heard the argument made that conservative smicha in the early 80s gave rabbis the right to be a dayan. That's the Grosh's basis. I don't know. It's a good question. We have to find people in the conservative movement. Is any, any conservative rabbi can serve as on a base then, I guess. I guess the implication is, yeah, if you're a rabbi, then it's a beis din, you could serve on it. Maybe that is what's behind all this. Even though the typical rabbi won't serve on a beis din, we know that he could if asked. So that's a good point, Bill. I hadn't heard that. That is an excellent point, actually. Mel says, I believe you said that Rav Schachter is the most influential posek in America. I assume you meant the most influential modern Orthodox posek. No, I don't mean that. I mean the most influential. Because if you take the modern Orthodox and the Haredi world, I still think he's the most influential because how do you define influence? Influence, if you look at someone, how much influence they have. I think if you look in terms of how many shuls and how many people he affects in his decisions, it's more influential even than Shmuel Kamenetsky, who would be, I guess, the senior Aguda Posek, because the Haredim have other Poski. But if you look in the modern Orthodox world, there's only really one Posek who stands above, who that doesn't mean they accept everything, but he really is more authoritative, also with the OU now. So I do think that he's the most influential in Orthodoxy as a whole in America. Avi says that Rabbi Adler starts davening early enough to make sure there's enough time for Halal to start the Seder on time. Very good. Okay. Two more minutes, we'll give it. Avi says, could there be a problem Losi Skoda do by leaving? If most of the shul is saying for Halal, what's the problem Losi Skoda do? You don't have to stay in. Before COVID, my shul used to say Vita Lacha. Then when we came back, all of a sudden Vita Lacha has been dropped. But I mean, if you would walk out for Vita Lacha because whatever, you want to schmooze with your friend, it's not Losi Skoda do. And we saw that Brisker Rav would leave. I'll read you the Lashon of the Brisker Rav that he would, leave. Now, why would he leave? Why couldn't he stay in there? He says he would leave Dafka Kadesh Lo Yekaporish Minatsiwa Bishtikaso Hagluya. The Brisker Rav would leave because if he stayed in there and he refused to say it, then he's a Porish Minatsiwa. So he doesn't want to be a Porish Minatsiwa, so therefore you leave. And when you're leaving, you're not there. So that's okay. Baruch says Rav Soloveitchik grew up far from Brisk. How can he know Brisker ways better than his uncle Ravovo? It's a good question, but that's not it's not really relevant because we don't have Ravovo saying that that Rav Chaim didn't say it. All we have is the children of Ravovo saying that Ravovo said it, which we know, and they're saying that the grandfather did as well. And the Rav is saying that he heard from his father the reason why Reb Chaim said it. So that's so it's not a question of, you know, living far away. It's that he's telling us that his father told him this, and the Rav describes the Lundus as well. I'm open Baruch. I didn't know I was open Orthodoxy. That's news. You know, I'm a Republican. At least I think I am, and they won't let me in open Orthodoxy. That's not. And Rabbi Opie says that his father in Philadelphia hired Rabbi Emil Eiberg, the first conservative rabbi. And yes, Rabbi Jack Reimer is on also, so a big honor as well. And thank you all. Again, thank you all for coming out. And Rabbi Kelman, take it away.
Thank you very much. I want to echo all the thoughts, and it's really been a pleasure. So many people coming, and of course, I guess it is. I think it's wonderful that we get people from, you know, conservative, reform, orthodox, the whole, you know, we're post-nominational in many ways. We're all here to learn Torah, all here to learn together, and that's a wonderful thing. And of course, I guess me coming from, you know, those who know me know the family that I come from. This, I guess, is, you know, my, obviously I have feet in anywhere from Lakewood to JTS to HUC, you know, and everything in between. And I'm very proud of that. And Baruch Hashem, how people know my family and know how well my father and his two brothers got along, despite their very different hashkapic orientations. And I always say that's a model for Klal Yisrael. So I think I'm very happy we could have such a class. You're right. I guess it was my idea to do it on Shul Lieberman. And, you know, one day we'll do it on Leo Beck. We'll have a class on Leo Beck, one of the leaders and the giants of the reform movement in Germany. And hello, made me call it dumb. There's what to learn for all of us from everybody. So I want to thank you all. And we look forward. Of course, we all know we have many classes. We still have two new classes this week. I just sent out an email earlier today, but keep posted. Tomorrow, for the first time, we're not having class on Tuesday. It's the first time we're not having class on Tuesday for a while, or any day of the week. We always have basically 6 days a week, but sort of as we transition, we've got a whole bunch of stuff coming up soon, but now a few extra classes, then we'll kick off our winter semester, or whatever you want to call it. And we're working with Dr. Mark on a couple of programs that we'll announce. And of course, we'll be back soon with his Monday night class, please God. And I want to thank everybody and wish everybody well. And okay, any comments or always willing to, you know, I always want to hear from you, constructive critique, ideas, suggestions. You know, I mention that all the time. Invite your friends. I'm always interested in ideas. And maybe I don't respond to everything. I try to respond, but we do take it all to heart, and we try to look for different things we can do. So especially since we're not doing trips. Mark was supposed to be in Morocco next week. We thought maybe we could get our first trip in a couple years, and until about 3 weeks ago, whenever this craziness struck again. And we thought we were going to Morocco, but obviously that ain't happening. So we'll be here, and let's learn together. Okay, I think I've spoken enough, and thank you, everybody. Have Laila Tov, be well. Thank you very much.
Laila Tov.
Laila Tov.
Thank you for all. Very well. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.